Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Diana Soriano. Diana and I actually share a similar story in that we both lost a loved one in Afghanistan while we were stationed there, while we were deployed there. Diana lost her fiance, Bobby Pagan, in 2010, which also happens to be the same year that my brother was killed in action. And she also has gone on to write a book about her experiences, which is titled In Loving Memory, A Story of Love, Loss, and Living On. And so welcome to the show, Diana.
Thank you, Scott, for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm when you reached out and told me a little bit about your story, I was eager to get you on the show and dig into your story a little bit more and find out about it, just because, well, first off, anyone who has gone through a loss like this, it certainly is a story worth telling. There's a lot of lessons that I'm sure you've learned along the way. I know I have. Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of combat related deaths like this, the unexpected deaths that take place, and so there's a lot of lessons to be learned, and I think it's great that you're willing to come on and share your story and talk about your experiences, and really get that information out there to help other people who may be going through similar circumstances. Whether it was in the last 20 some odd years of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or even in the future, this country is not immune from wars. So we may be going down that path in the future in some other part of the world, and unfortunately, with war comes situations like the ones that we've both experienced, and I think it's great that you're willing to share your experiences to hopefully help some other people. So, before we dig into your story and your experiences, let's start with a little bit about yourself. What got you into the military? What got your interest in it? And how did you end up meeting Bobby?
So, I was raised in a house of domestic violence, and my parents met when they were teenagers. They were actually in middle school, had my brother in high school. There was a lot of issues between them, and my dad was on and off drugs. My mom, when they split, was an alcoholic, and she was very abusive towards me and my brother. So my background was really rough, and it came to a point where I was living with other family members to kind of get away and try to get a break. But I found myself always kind of moving back and forth ever since sixth grade, actually. And then at 17, between my sophomore and junior year, I finally just had enough and ended up living with one last family member, and then from her, I lived with my first boyfriend. And he ended up cheating on me, and we broke up, of course, and so he kicked me out, and I was pretty much homeless. And I was in high school, and I was just determined not to end up on the streets and not to end up doing nothing with my life. Kind of, my parents made some pretty bad choices growing up, and I just took that as an example of what I didn't want to do. I wanted to do the complete opposite and, be successful in life. And so I joined the military because I was running out of options. Thankfully, I was part of a church program called Celebrate Recovery in Henderson, Nevada with Central Christian Church. And I went there for abuse recovery because I was a survivor of abuse. And my sponsor, Molly, helped me out because, like I said, I was homeless. So she put me in an extended stay hotel until I turned 18, which was, I think, about 3 or 4 months. And then after I was 18, she helped me get into my first apartment down the street from my school. And I had to work 2 to 3 jobs to pay for the bills and the rent for that. So that kind of showed academically the stress, what I was going through. And my grades started to decline a little bit, but I was still on track to graduate, and I was determined to graduate. But I also had to stop playing sports, so I lost all scholarships. You had to have a certain grade point average. I think it was like a 3.5 or a 3.8 to get a certain scholarship that I was trying to go for, and I lost that. I think I graduated with like a 3.0 or something like that. And so I was running out of options, and I felt like all the doors were closing in on me, and it scared me because I was so determined not to turn out like my parents and to make something of myself. And I was like, how am I going to afford to pay for college? Like, what am I going to do with my life? This isn't it for me. And my older brother had moved out a few years before me and joined the military, and he seemed to be doing great. So he was kind of the lead on that, and I kind of always followed in his footsteps as a kid. And so when he was successful in it, I said, if he could do it, I can do it. I never pictured myself in the military, honestly, but it's the best decision I've ever made in my life, and I stand by that to this day. So I joined the military, and off I went to boot camp.
Yeah. And I've heard that from a lot of people where they came from, you know, a troubled home, that things weren't the picture perfect life that people are hoping for. Right. And, they feel like they've run out of options. They join the military. And it completely changes the trajectory of their life, and it works out for the better. Like you said, it's one of the best decisions that you've ever made. And, you know, it's good that there's something like that out there for people who are in that situation where they feel like, I don't know what else to do. Right. And it's a noble thing to do, to serve your country. And, you know, but it also helps you out as well. So it's kind of a, you know, one hand washing the other kind of thing. It's you're helping the country out, the country's helping you out, and everyone benefits from it. So I think that's incredible that you found that and went down that path, as opposed to, like you said, going down the wrong path that would have had you continuing in the footsteps of you know, the life that you were growing up in. So okay. So that's great that you did that, right? And what about your fiance? How did you guys end up meeting, and what was that all like?
So I had a friend who I met in basic training. Her name is Rendell Logan, now Rendell Logan Torre. And she and I got stationed together at Fort Carson. So we went to basic training together, AIT together, and got stationed at our first duty station together, which is like rare. And I had never met her before basic training, so it was kind of cool. She got there before me, about a week before me, and she had met this guy named Bailey. That was his last name. And Bailey happened to be at the DFACT, the military cafeteria, for those who don't know. Happened to be at a DFACT with a bunch of guys in a booth, and we were leaving the DFACT from the in processing center. And so as we were leaving, she came across Bailey in the booth of guys, and Bobby happened to be with them. And she introduced me and was like, hey, this is Soriano, and Bailey, and countless other people couldn't pronounce my last name. They say like Sereno, Serrano, some weird names or whatever. And I just laughed because people always chop up my last name. And Bobby spoke up and he was like, Soriano. And like, he rolled the R. And I smiled and I was like, yeah, you got it. And he smiled back and like had my attention. And I read his name tape. And then Bailey said something like smart and the whole table laughed. But I don't know what he said because I was like focused on Bobby and reading his name tape. And everybody just laughed. And after that, we left. And as we were walking back, I guess somebody wrote to Logan, I don't know if it was Bailey or Bobby or who, and asked if Bobby can have my phone number. And at first I was like, hell no, I don't know him. But she was always like, you gotta live a little, Soriano. And or she called me Reno. And she would just be like, why don't you just open up a little and whatnot? So she was lecturing me the whole way back. And by the time we got to the in-processing barracks, I was like, okay, you can give him my number. And so she did.
Okay. And that was the beginning of
everything.
Of everything, the whole relationship and everything. And when you got in process there, you weren't in the same unit as Bobby at the time. Is that correct? Or you correct. Had to end up getting transferred into the unit that he was in right. order to, as deploy. When we talked before, in order to deploy on the same schedule. Otherwise, you'd basically be apart from each other the whole time, right?
Right. Yeah. So I was in 3-4 and Logan, Bailey, a few of other friends that we met in processing, they were all in 4-4. So in 3-4, we were part of a brigade special troops battalion. That's where I was assigned. And they were geared to go to Iraq. Bobby's unit with 4-4 was going to Afghanistan. And the people who were in my unit were already in Iraq returning. So I was on rear D. Whereas they were gearing up, going to NTC and all of that stuff to go out there. So,
yeah. So you end up getting transferred into the same unit. So you ended up deploying at the same time to mm-hmm. Afghanistan, correct?
Right.
Now, what was that deployment like? You know, where were you stationed, and how? You know, what were you doing over there and everything like that?
So the deployment itself wasn't terrible. You know, you hear horror stories and all that, and I really can't complain a whole lot about my experience in the deployment apart from what happened after I lost Bobby. But, you know, prior to that, he left, and so were most of my friends because they were all in his unit. And I had confided in an NCO the day after he left about the whole issue with, well, let me give you a little bit of backstory. Before Bobby left, we spent a lot of time together, and his last day there as a private, I didn't know that I could like ask my supervisor, hey, can I have the day off? Because my fiance, well, then boyfriend, was about to deploy. Like, you know, I'm a private, and back then you just did as you were told. You didn't ask no questions, nothing, right? This was like 2008.
Yep.
So I didn't know. And when I found out, my NCOIC at the time, like, yelled at me. At first, she, like, gave me, like, a one-second hug. Like, I kid you not. It was, like, 1 second because she felt bad. Then she, like, pushed me off and yelled at me. It was like, Soriano, why didn't you tell me? I would have gave you the day off. And like my heart sank and I was just like, oh, I was so upset. Like, you know, I was distraught because he was gone. And another NCO told me, like, you know that you guys aren't going to be on the same deployment cycle. And I was like, well, what is that? And she was like, when he comes back, you're either already going to be in Iraq or you're going to be headed to Iraq. And I was like, what? I was like, I don't want it to be prolonged any longer. You know? Yeah. So she was like, well, you know, they're always needing people because people get pregnant or things happen and they need females to replace the other ones. So she's like, if I were you, I would have you change deployment cycles and volunteer to deploy for him to get on the same deployment cycle. So I did. Thinking about it, I was like, what the hell was I thinking? But I totally did all over again. So I was like, okay, sign me up. And she had a person who she knew who was her former soldier, Staff Sergeant Ocampo, who to this day is like my favorite NCOIC. And whatever they did the paperwork to get me over to a 4-4, and then I deployed with them. And I happened to be in the same exact S1 shop, HR shop with Logan. So that was cool. Because like you go to basic training, AIT, first duty station, end up in the same exact shop in Afghanistan. It's like crazy, right?
Right.
But I feel like personally, I'm a woman of faith. I have religious beliefs and I believe in God. And I feel like God did that on purpose. You know, he was setting me up to have the support that I needed, you know.
For sure. I'm sure that that is the case, and that you had that friend there who knew you all along from, you know, basic training all throughout the same journey. You guys went on, you know, basically the same exact path. You had a lot of the same experiences, the same, you know, people that you were with and everything. And you guys just stuck together. And that's pretty incredible, especially in the military where people move around and get stationed in different places all over the world, really. And you still manage to stick with the same person throughout. That actually is pretty incredible, I think.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. But, so,
yeah, I, go oh, ahead. Sorry. Okay. So no, I got go out there and everybody thought I was like brand new out of AIT. So they didn't know that even to this day, some people are like, what? You were in another unit? They don't know that I was in 3-4 this whole time. So I get out there and they put me on casualty operations. So basically it was on the personal readiness management side of the house, and I had to track casualties. I had to work with the medics to get the information on the casualties, send it up to hire, send it back to the states and whatnot. And the first one was a bit difficult because my first casualty that I had to deal with was a person who was killed in action. And I think it was somebody on, Cop Keating, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was like their commander or one of the lieutenants or something. And when you first get the reports, it's kind of vague. And so it's like, okay, I think I got this. When you start getting more of the details, that's when it starts getting hard. And I can only imagine what it was like for the people who are actually there. You know what I mean? So my first casualty, I had to get myself mentally prepared for that. And my NCO, her name was Sergeant Wang. She pulled me to the side and she just said, hey, you know, you got to have thick skin to be able to work on this side of the house. And I believe you have that thick skin, but you can't let it get to you. I know some of these reports are going to be very difficult to read, but you have to do your part. She told me the importance of the job, you know, without going into specific details, told me the importance of the job and said, like, I can do it, just drive on. So I did. And it was really sad getting a lot of those reports because you know, you hear about dismemberment or like shrapnel in crazy areas or just, you know, it's just insane, like what these people experience and what they go through. And as I was going through, I was constantly reaching out to Bobby, like, hey, please be careful. Like, this is crazy, you know, but I never thought I would lose him. I was naive to the fact that he was an infantryman. I just didn't fully understand it back then, like what it all entailed and what they actually do. You know, here I am in HR with freaking internet and telephones. We got like green beans down the road. You know what I mean? Like, we didn't have a whole lot on Jalalabad, which is where I was, but there was a green beans and like you can go across the airfield and get like cinnamon naan. And you know what I mean? It was so different compared to what he had experienced, where he was like out there building a cop and like had nothing and rarely had internet and like nothing. You know what I mean? Didn't even have like an MWR. Right. Hardly had hot chow. Like, it was crazy. So our conditions were very different, but I didn't really understand it at the time. So I used to get upset sometimes when I didn't hear from him, and I was just like, well, don't you want to talk to me? Like, why aren't you talking to me? And he had these little like push button Afghani cell phones out there that everybody had, and that's how we would communicate with each other. And I was like, you don't have that out there? And he was like, no, man, I don't have this shit. So it was definitely a transition for me, and trying to understand that it was just complete opposite for him. And he was actually down south, below Kandahar. We were in the eastern region in Jalalabad. So we were completely separate. His unit, like his battalion, was the only one in our brigade that was pushed down south. So it was weird. I don't know why that was. But he was very far, so nowhere near each other. Which was a surprise to us because we thought, you know, we'd be like seeing each other here and there and passing or whatever, and it just wasn't the case.
Right. Well, and it's interesting too because when you get to Afghanistan, I know for me, anyways, you don't realize how isolated certain areas are. In Afghanistan, even though it may only be 10, 20 miles away, which, you know, around here in the United States, 10, 20 miles away, okay, just hop in the car, drive, and, you know, you're there in a little bit. But 10 or 20 miles away there could be like a really, really long journey, depending on the mountain terrain and things like that. Like if you were to get in a truck and drive that way, you might have to go all the way around all these mountains to get to where you're going, because there's no way you're going over the mountains, because they're just so crazy over there. Things are very isolated. Even my brother and I, when we were in Afghanistan, we're both in Eastern Afghanistan, but we were about 80 or so miles apart, 80 or 90 miles apart. We never saw each other once when we were in Afghanistan. We never had the opportunity to see each other.
Where were you guys?
So I was in Torkum, which is right on the Afghan border. And actually not too far from Jalalabad. We actually drove there a few times to get resupplies and drop things off at there. And it was funny, you were talking about the cinnamon flatbread. I know exactly where you're talking about, because we'd stop there, we knew where it was, and we'd all go and pig out on that stuff, because we didn't have that stuff on our base. And then he was in Paktia province, which also was near the Pakistan border. It was just a little bit further away from where we were. So we were both there, and kind of interesting how we all get kind of spread out, but you know, it's really not that far in the grand scheme of things, but it is when you're talking about Afghan distances, because you just can't travel that far. And one of the questions that I always get from people is that they wonder how two brothers wound up deployed to the same country at the same time. They're usually under the impression that based on the movie Saving Private Ryan, that they can't possibly let siblings deploy together because of everything that the people went through in that movie, trying to get people out and everything like that. Turns out they can. Turns out that they can deploy together, and they do, obviously, because my brother and I did. But even if that were true in the eyes of the military, you and your fiance weren't technically related up until that point, because you weren't married, right?
Right.
So I mean, you had some great leadership that managed to get you on that same deployment schedule, so that you guys could be together at least as much as possible, and at least if you weren't together while you're deployed, you could be together while you're home, right?
Right.
But as far as the military was concerned, that you weren't actually related to each other at that point in time, right?
No. So yeah, I just volunteered so that when we came back, that we could have that time together and proceed forward with whatever plans we had.
Yeah, exactly. And so I know this is probably a hard situation to talk about, but what was the day that he was killed? What was that like for you? What happened when you were notified, and how did you get notified, and what took place during all those events?
So, okay, yeah, this is very, very, a very touchy subject, but basically they had moved me from the casualty section to a ward. So went through casualties, did all that, had literally the cop cheating incident, which was insane. Then we had a person come from Rear D out to Afghanistan, and she kind of took over. She was a specialist. I was a PFC. So she kind of took over my position in casualties, and I got pushed to awards. And so when the report came in, like, I kind of already knew how the folders go. So we had blue folders and red folders. Red folders meant it was a very serious injury, or the person was killed in action. Blue folder meant that they were injured, but it wasn't like a grave situation, or they were seen at a hospital and could be returned to duty shortly. So it was one of those type things. When the reports came in, my former coworker, Sergeant Lamping, she looked up and looked straight at me like, uh-oh. That's the best way I can describe her face. Like, uh-oh, or oh shit. And that look triggered something in me just to be like, oh my gosh, what happened? And so I'm watching her trying to do my work. I had, I know you're not supposed to have headphones in, but I had an earpiece in one ear plugged into, you know, listening to music. And I'm watching her grab folders, and she grabbed 3 red folders and 2 blue ones. So there was 2 others who died with Bobby that day. But I was praying and like talking to myself in my head, like, please God, let it be a blue folder. And like the whole time I was on casualties, I never saw his name. And I know it's sad to say, but I was so thankful that it was never him. And so when I seen her face, I was like, oh my gosh, he's a casualty. I just don't know what it is. And when you're in that section, you cannot say anything until the family is notified. Regardless, it doesn't matter if you're in the same shop, in the same unit, whatever. You can't say anything at all. It's like a blackout, until, which means no communication, until the families are notified. And so I'm freaking out, and I'm like, what is it? Is it red? Is it blue? Like, is he injured? Like, and it sucks to say this, but like in my head, I'm like, is he get dismembered? Like, are his legs blown off? His arm blown? Like, is he okay? Like, I can handle that. Like, I'll, you know, deal with it as it comes. But they weren't saying anything to me. And so I went out to the hallway and I grabbed a bottle of water. When I came back in, Sergeant Lamping was talking to the major and they were whispering, and I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I know something was wrong. And so I'm freaking myself out. I'm starting to get anxiety, and I started to feel tears well up in my eyes. And back then, you were not allowed to show emotion. You just weren't. The only emotion that was acceptable for some reason was anger. You know, people applauded you if you fucking went off on somebody, you know. I don't know, it was insane. So I went to the bathroom to get my life together. I wiped away my tears, washed my face. I was like, okay, stop freaking out. You're okay. And I go back in, and she is leaning over talking to my NCO at the time, who was Sergeant Tejeda. And she had a very concerned look on her face. And so I was like, fuck, like something's going on. People are starting to look at me like they're concerned. And I'm like, how is it that they know what's going on? We're not supposed to tell anybody. So that's how I knew, like, okay, he's for sure injured. Like, something is wrong. And they had called in my best friend, Logan, and told her to distract me. I didn't know this, of course. It took her, honestly, it wasn't till like a year or two ago that she finally like admitted to me, like, hey, I knew. And she just carried that guilt for years. But so on the back end of the story, they called her and said, hey, we need you to take out Soriano and distract her until we figure out what we're going to do. They told her Bobby was a casualty, but they didn't give her the details. So she like really couldn't. And then they threatened her, like, you know, you'll get an Article 15 if you say anything, like, you know, the rules and whatever. And so she's stressed out and she has to lie to me, and I'm her best friend. So she came in, and I typically, at that time I was working a swing shift. So I typically went to lunch, which was my dinner, and then I would go work out. So we went to the defag, and I just couldn't eat. I just had like this terrible feeling, like I knew something was really wrong. And I was like trying to hold back the tears. And I told her, like, Logan, something's wrong. And she said, don't think like that, Soriano. And that was a key, like, I guess, instinct or like alert to me, because she never called me Soriano. She always called me Reno, which is her nickname for me. Okay. She was one of the ones who used to screw up my name. And she just, she knows how to say it now, but her nickname for me is Reno. And so I was like, wait, she don't ever call me Soriano. Like, you know, and she was kind of jittery and stuff. And she was just like, you got to think positive. And I'm like, something's wrong. Like, something's off about the situation. But they let me go. So I'm like, okay, maybe it wasn't like he's not killed in action. Like, maybe it's just like he's really seriously injured. So she goes back to the office, and I go to my room, and I changed into PTs because I was going to go work out. That was typically my routine. And I'm looking at his pictures that I had taped on my wall, and I'm just like pacing back and forth. And I'm like, please God, like, please let him be okay. He has to be okay. And then, and I'm thinking this in my head. And then out loud, I just told myself, like, no, like, he has to be okay. Like, he promised me. He promised me he was coming back. He's going to be okay. And then I heard, like, a soft knock on my door. Oh, my heart's starting to race right now. I'm starting to feel, like, the emotions. Like, my chest is pretty tight. So sorry if I crack or choke up a little bit.
No, that's okay.
So Sergeant Tejeda was knocking on my door. And she just said, hey, they need you at the office. And she, like, completely tried to avoid eye contact. And I locked eyes with her. Like, I made her ass look at me. And I was like, are you sure? Please, Sergeant Tejeda. Like, are you sure you don't know what's going on? And she just looked straight ahead at my door. She didn't look at me. She, like, removed her eyes. And she just said, I'm sure. And so I grabbed my rifle. And we started walking back to the office. And the office was, like, really close. I want to say less than 500 feet away. But it felt like it was a 3-mile-long walk. And, like, I was just watching the dust kick up on my feet, and the dirt and the gravel. And it was the longest walk of my life. And my heart was pounding. My chest is getting tight. I was shaking. Like, I'm like, something's wrong. I can feel it. I just had this gut feeling. And so she puts in the trench coat to the talk and opens it, and we go in, and there was, like, this long corridor. So you turn to the right, then you make a left, and it's a long corridor down to our office. But before then, it kind of cuts off and veers to the right. There's an option for you to go to the right where the Sergeant Major's office was. And so as we get to that area, I see Sergeant Ocampo standing outside of Sergeant Major's office, and Sergeant Tejeda's kind of, like, pushing me to the left, or, like, you know, having me go to the right. And as I go, like, I'm holding these tears, and I couldn't hold it anymore. And I just, like, I was like, Sergeant Ocampo, like, and he didn't say anything. He just pointed to the office across from the Sergeant Major. And there was, like, this brownish black leather couch and a table and, like, a fold out chair. And another fold-out chair, I think, like, towards the front entrance of it. And I go in there, and I just sit down. And my Sergeant Major at the time, Command Sergeant Major Sasser, came in with our chaplain, Chaplain Madge. And I had my hands on my thighs, on my lap. And he grabbed my right hand and, like, just put it on the table. And he looked at me. Sorry. And he asked me, and he just said, like, is Specialist Pagan your fiance? And I said, yes, Sergeant Major. And at that point, like, I'm tearing up. Like, you're not supposed to cry, but, like, tears are flowing. And I'm trying my best to, like, hold it together. And he just says, I'm sorry to inform you, but Specialist Bobby Pagan was killed in action. And, like, I felt like everything just went black for a second. And I'm sorry. And
take your time.
Sorry.
No, you're good.
I am. I screamed at the top of my lungs. And I was just like, no, like, just screaming. And Sergeant Ocampo had sat down on that couch next to the major, but he was in between me and the major. And I just turned to my left where he was, and I, like, grabbed his arm tight. And I was like, please, Sergeant Ocampo, like, no, like, tell me they're lying, please. And he just hugged me. And he hugged me, and then I seen, like, the major get up, and Sergeant Major get up, and the chaplain step forward, like, they were closing in on me, like, they wanted to hug me or something. And I was like, no, like, I want Logan. And so Sergeant Ocampo went out to go grab Logan, because our office was right around the corner. And I'm in there like crying, and Logan just comes running in with her arms like wide open, ready to like embrace me. And I jumped up from the chair and I just like clung to her. And I was just like, Logan, like, they killed my baby. Like, why? Like, God. And she just hugged me so tight. And she was like, I know, Soriano, everything's going to be okay. And I was just like, no, no, it's not. And I just cried and cried into her chest. Like, her whole uniform top was just soaked in tears. I was completely in shock. And in so much pain at the same time. Like, I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting them to tell me, like, hey, he lost a leg, or hey, he, like, lost an arm. Something, you know? He can't walk anymore. Like, he's gonna be in a wheelchair, you know? Something. But that he was alive and headed to Germany to Launchstuhl to be in a hospital, you know? I was not expecting them to tell me that he died. And I think I didn't hear what Sergeant Major said. And I think it was when I returned that I actually, like, read the report and figured out, like, kind of when I came back. So let me give you that story. I was going through the motions. And then when I calmed down enough, Sergeant Major sat me down and he was like, we're going to treat you guys as if you were married and we're going to send you home. And so you can go on emergency leave to bury him. And I didn't realize how great and how amazing my leadership was to do that for me until I was in another unit later on down the road. And they're like, what? They sent you home? Because here I am, just this private. Mm-hmm. And I lost my fiance. They didn't have to send me home. And I didn't realize that until later on. And I'm so grateful that they gave me that opportunity. I don't think I would have made it through had they not, if that makes any sense.
It does, for sure.
And they did. They told me that I could go home, and he said that we're going to send you out bright and early in the morning. This was on the 13th. And so, but he said the family has not been notified. So in the meantime, you have to be put in your room and it's complete blackout until we notify the family. So of course they didn't leave me by myself. You know, they put you on buddy watch. They had Logan in there with me. They had Sergeant Tejeda in there with me and my roommate at the time. And so I was in there with them and they were talking to me about Bobby and I was just looking at our pictures and crying and reading the letters we wrote to each other, and I just felt so alone. Even though they were there, like, I don't know how to describe it. I just felt so alone. Like, there was no one who understood. There was no one who could make it better. There was no one who could help me with whatever I needed help with, right? I didn't know what I needed in the moment, but I know no one could provide it. I guess the comfort or whatever it was that I needed in that moment. So I was locked in the room for 12 hours. 12 hours. It was the 14th when they finally, like, let me out of my room and let me go. So I subconsciously hate Valentine's Day because it was the next day, you know. He was killed February 13th of 2010. And so when they finally notified Sergeant Tejeda that the family was notified, I don't know if it was like a phone call or text message. I just know she was in the room and they said, hey, they've been notified. I grabbed my little Afghani cell phone and I called my older brother because, you know, he's a service member. And when I was a kid, I looked up to him a lot. And I don't know why. I just, in that moment, I needed to hear his voice. And so I called him and he was just like, oh, man, I'm so sorry, sis. I'm so sorry. But he didn't really know what to say or how to comfort me either. Who does, you know, in that situation? And so he was like, you know, why don't you just call mom? And me and my mom weren't on talking terms at the time, but at that point I was desperate for, like, love in that moment. And so I called my mom and, you know, she asked me, like, what happened and where I was gonna be and, you know, was I going? And I said, yeah, I'm going to Texas. And she just said, you know, I'm sorry, going through this, you're going to get it, or you're going to get through it, and, you know, keep your chin up. And then they finally let me out of my room. And Logan had packed, like, an assault pack full of just clothes, like, you know, undergarments and clothes to get me through the next few days. And so when they let me out of my room, they took me to the office so they could do up the paperwork, and they were trying to get me out on a helicopter to Bagram. And so when I got to the office, that's when I, like, looked up the report and was just like, okay, this is what happened. So what happened was Bobby's unit was on patrol, and they were walking back to the base where they were, and he stopped to give candy to a mother and her children. And that's totally how Bobby was. He was that kind gentleman, always trying to get people to smile, you know. And as he was giving them candy, an Afghani on a motorcycle drove by and, like, detonated himself. And he was a suicide bomber on a motorcycle, and he killed Bobby and two others as he detonated himself, and then he injured a couple more. And man, it just broke my heart. It just broke my heart because he was doing what he does best, which was rendering an act of kindness, and they just killed him, you know? So that was hard. And I called his mom, and of course she's crying and distraught, and she's like, are you sure it's him? Are they sure? And I said, yeah, I'm sure, you know, they verified it was him. But I was hopeful that there was a mistake, because earlier that year, there was a mistake with notifying the wrong family for a casualty. They had notified the wrong family for someone who they thought was killed, and it was, like, a big ordeal. Like, my major was pissed, and, like, I don't know what happened. It was done stateside. And I found out later by reading, you know, through the obituaries and all that stuff, that another person was actually notified. Another family was notified with Bobby's incident for a different soldier in a completely different unit who was out there. And so it happened, but unfortunately, Bobby was, in fact, killed in action. So I let her know that I was going to go home to Texas and be there to bury him. And I had never met Bobby's family before this time. We were planning on going on leave. So the unfortunate part was we had 2 weeks left before we were supposed to go on R&R, and we were planning to go to the Texas coast for a family vacation. I was supposed to meet his family for the first time, and he was going to introduce me as his fiance. And that unfortunately just didn't happen. So I let them know, you know, I was going to take my leave, and I was going to go on emergency leave. So they gave me R&R in conjunction with emergency leave. So I was in Texas for about a month. Which I'm thankful for, because I was able to be there for the viewing and for his funeral, and then for the memorial that they had with the unit back on Rarity. But I let her know, and then the rest of the way, the trip there was kind of like a blur. I was going through the motions, but, like, mentally, I was just so checked out. My mind was, like, racing, trying to figure out, like, is this real? Like, is this really happening? And I felt, like, insane, because I knew that this was real, but I was questioning my reality. Like, am I really going home to, like, bury him? Am I really going home to meet his family on my own? Like, did this really happen? Or is this, like, a really, really terrible, ugly, horrible dream? And unfortunately, it wasn't. So yeah, that's how I was notified.
Yeah, and I know in my circumstance, and first off, thank you for sharing that. I know talking about that situation is never an easy thing to do and everything, but I'm glad you're able to share that. But I know from my situation, when my brother was killed, it was like all the military bearing just went out the window. Of the saluting and, you know, sir or ma'am to the officers and everything like that was like, I didn't care anymore. Like, mm-hmm. None of that stuff mattered to me. And I think everybody that I interacted with recognize that, and they, like, nobody like faulted me for it. You know, all of those military customs and all that kind of stuff was like, I just didn't care. And so I know what you mean, like things just feeling like it's either going in slow motion or like a blur or whatever. Yeah. Like it's just a really weird situation and a weird feeling that you have. But you said you went to Bagram after leaving Jalalabad. Mm-hmm. Were you able to attend the ceremony? Like they have a ramp ceremony where they bring the fallen onto the plane that takes them out of there. Were you there for that, or were you there after or before or whatever?
No, I wasn't there for his in particular. Later on in the deployment, they put me on a ramp ceremony detail where we had to stand and salute as the fallen soldiers were carried onto the airplane. And that was extremely difficult. But at the time, I got moved to Bagram, and the NCOIC there, his name was Master Sergeant Robledo, he, in my opinion, hated me. Like, this man was out to get me. And I don't know if it was because at that time, all bearing, like, left me. When I returned to Afghanistan, they had given me the option to come back or to go beyond Verde in Fort Carson, Colorado. And I was like, there's no way I'm going back to Colorado. There's nothing for me there. Like, I'm going to finish out this deployment. I'm going to do it for Bobby. And so I went back, and everybody avoided me like a freaking plague because nobody knew what to say other than Logan. And then I had a really good friend named Rob Wenzel. Unfortunately, Rob died recently. And he pushed me in the gym. He was my workout buddy. And he just let me vent all the time and cry. And then he was like, okay, now we're going to let it out with a workout. And I did. And I was so thankful for him. But other than those two, honestly, people didn't talk to me. I don't know if it was they were scared to talk to me because they didn't know what to say, or they were just scared of my wrath. Because if you pissed me off when I got back, I just didn't care. I was going to cuss your ass out, threaten you, like, get the hell out of my way. Don't say shit to me. Like, it was a really, really bad time for me as far as bearing, and I got into it with my NCOs, and they just had so much patience and grace with me that looking back, I'm like, why the hell did they not like put me in my place or demote me, or like, I was a private, you know what I mean, like,
right,
cussing right out this like Sergeant E5, and like, oh man, it was just terrible, you know. But I also understand the aspect that, like, they knew I was grieving, and so they gave me that grace. So I, right, I understand, but I feel like that was a step of failure because I continued on my path for a hot minute like that.
Right. yeah.
So, but yeah.
So you went back to Afghanistan, and you were you finished out that deployment, which to me is pretty incredible. I know when I came home after my brother was killed, I didn't go back to Afghanistan. And honestly, I don't know how I would have been able to go back, you know, how I would have managed. And I can't imagine how you managed after that type of loss and then getting sent back. Obviously it was your choice. You had the option of staying in Colorado or going back to Afghanistan. But, to me, it just seems like that would have been an incredibly hard decision to make, but that's what you did. Yeah.
But honestly, I feel like I made that decision because my support system was in Afghanistan. Logan was in Afghanistan, and there's no way I would have been able to reach her like on a daily basis or as needed if I was back in the States, because, you know, communications back then wasn't very easy. Like, we didn't have cell phones like FaceTime and all that crap back then, you know. This was 2008. Well, actually by then it was 2009 2010, so it was very different, and I needed that support system in that time. So I felt like I just needed to go back because that's where they were, you know.
Yeah, sure. Now, what was the healing process like for you? So you're in Afghanistan, obviously, you're having a little bit of trouble while you're over there, right? And fortunately, the people who were there were giving you that grace and understanding that you needed to kind of get through that deployment. But what about when you got home? What was the process like for you, and how did that take place?
It was very chaotic, to say the least. So, of course, in Afghanistan, you stay busy. You don't really have much else to do but work and work out. So I stayed really busy. And when I got back home stateside, it was not so busy. So you have work, your work hours, and then after that you have your downtime in the evenings. And the evenings were so hard for me. I couldn't sleep. I was struggling. Like, I didn't really want to eat too much. I didn't want to go out. I was really grieving. I was really mm-hmm. in depression. And of course, like I said, back then you weren't really supposed to show any kind of emotion, but they accepted anger outbursts for whatever reason. Back then they thought you were squared away if you're cussing out some person who was lower ranked than you, trying to get them squared away, right?
Right.
So I totally took on that persona and was like that person who would just set you straight and came at you with regulations and all stuff, and I was very untactful, to say the least, toxic, I would even say. But they were praising me for it. And they're like, oh man, you go far in your career. And I'm like, what the hell's wrong with these people? I'm over here dying on the inside, taking it out on y'all. And y'all are telling me, great job. You're gonna be an NCO soon. What the hell? So I was struggling. And for some reason, I was underage, but for some reason, I always had access to alcohol. And it's sad to say, but I was numbing myself. Honestly, I went to the redeployment ceremony for Bobby's unit because I had gotten close to his friends, before we left. And I just remember it being so emotional. It was emotional when I came back because, you're out there and people are cheering and they're playing American Soldier and freaking Red, White, and Blue, and it just gives you this super huge sense of pride. And then I'm just dying on the inside because I now have a new fond feeling and meaning behind the national anthem. And man, so I went to their redeployment ceremony, and one of his close friends, I would say best friend, for who was in Colorado, his name was Macias, he came back, and I was there with his family and Logan. And it was just so sad to see his dad crying, this grown man crying and shaking and embracing his son, so thankful that he came back, and his sisters and his mom. Then he just comes up to me and all he said was, hey sis. And unfortunately Macias was on leave when Bobby died, so when he came back he found out, so it was just crazy. But he said, hey sis, and I just freaking lost it. I cried in his arms, and it was hard, but I was always with Macias and Bobby's other friend, Bradley. His last name was Bradley. Sure. And they, of course, were 21, and I didn't turn 21 until that following January. So whether I was with them or Logan, they were all older than me. Bobby, Logan, all of our friends were older than me. I was the youngest one, but I always had access to alcohol. And so I would just drink and get drunk and just talk about Bobby and cry. And it would get bad because I would just pass out and Macias would just put me in his bed and then he would sleep on the floor, which I was thankful for. He took care of me in that sense. He always made sure I was okay and didn't leave until the next day, because I kind of got into one of my other friends where I didn't make the very best impression on Wenzel, when I told you about earlier. I didn't make the best impression on his wife, Kelly. And kind of made a fool of myself at their party, just over drinking and just being in my feelings.
Right.
And she didn't make me feel welcome. And I was like, F this. I had that attitude back then. I'm leaving. And he was like, nope, no, you're not. You just drank. I'm not giving you your keys. And he took the keys. And I was so mad. I was like, I want to get the hell out of here. And this other NCO happened to be there. I don't remember his name. I just remember he was a redhead. And he just yelled at me and cussed me out in front of everybody. And I was so pissed because someone finally put me in my place. Right. And I was just right. Oh, hell no. So I'm on the verge of tears and I'm just pissed off, and I storm out, and little did I know, like, my wallet, my freaking ID card to get on a post, everything's in my vehicle, and freaking Wenzel has my damn keys. So all I have is my cell phone. And I call Logan. I'm like, Logan, he took my damn keys and I can't get back. And she agreed with him, of course, because, you know, they're sober. And they're like, you're not going to drive drunk. And I was so pissed. And that was like one of the only arguments I've ever had with Logan in my life. And it just got so ugly in that moment. I was just like, what am I doing with myself? Like, you know, like, I'm losing friendships. And like, I seriously, seriously value both of their friendships, especially Logan's. And I was like, I got to get it together. But unfortunately, that just still didn't stop. You know, it wasn't until I was sexually assaulted that I was like, okay, cold turkey, I'm done with this shit, because my decisions are causing me harm in the long run. And I had to stop drinking. That was my wake up call. Like, Diana, stop. Get your shit together. Like, you're not an alcoholic. You just need to deal with this and find a different outlet. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, for sure. And unfortunately, that is a coping mechanism that a lot of us choose to use. You know, just self-medicating with alcohol, just numbing that pain, and it works temporarily, but the pain doesn't actually go away. It just just makes it feel like it's not there for a little while, Yeah, it's not the best way to go, is it? Right?
No, not at all. I would not recommend.
No, exactly. So if you were to have one message that you'd like to get across to other people who maybe experienced a loss, maybe not exactly the same way that you did, but maybe it's a military related loss or some other unexpected kind of loss like that. What would you like that message to be? What would you like to tell these people and have them take away from your story and your experience?
So I guess the main message that I want to put out there is, no matter how difficult the circumstances are, and even if you may feel like you're just never going to get through it, God will get you through it. You know what I mean? If it's 1 hour at a time, 1 minute at a time, like a moment at a time, you're going to get through it. I would also say, let it out. I stuffed and stuffed for years those emotions, trying to hide it, trying to be strong. And here I am going on 12 years later, and I'm still dealing with these emotions because I stuffed it. It's okay to cry. It's okay to let it out. And I would say, find a healthy outlet, whether that be writing, whether that be exercising, whether that be going to seek therapy, you know, whatever it is that's going to help you to let it out in a healthy way, I recommend it. But know that you're not alone. For one, there are so many people who understand loss. They may not understand your particular situation or circumstance, but they understand the feeling that you're going through with loss, with the grieving and the emptiness and the feeling of abandonment, honestly, because people don't talk about like that feeling of abandonment from your loved one, you know, none of that. But people understand, people care. And it's going to be okay. I honestly feel like the pain never goes away, at least in my experience. It doesn't go away. You learn to live with it. You learn to live without your loved one. So there's kind of like a void. You know what I mean?
Right.
But life has to go on. And you're going to go on with life. You're going to be okay, one step at a time.
I think that's a great message. And probably a great place to wrap this episode up. I know this is, you know, a difficult thing to go through for anybody. And for anyone who is struggling out there, you know, I think that message was spot on, you know, that there are people who care and that there are, you know, ways of dealing with this that are healthier than the ways that, that, you know, some of us have chosen to cope with these things. But, you know, that loss is something that you're going to learn to live with. You may not like it, you may not want to, but you know, life isn't going to be exactly the same. It's going to be different, and you're going to learn to live with that different aspect in your life. And Diana, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, hearing your story, really an incredible story. I'm glad you came on and shared it with us. And again, for the listeners who are listening to this, the book is In Loving Memory, A Story of Love, Loss, and Living On. Could you tell us where people can go to get a copy of your book and find out more information about you and your story?
Sure. It's on all main platforms, you know, Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble. I think there's like three other sites. If you Google it, it'll pop up. So, and that has a lot more of the details in the book.
Yeah, and I'll have a link to the book in the show notes so that anyone who is looking to grab a copy of the book, it'll be there for you. Please get a copy of the book, read it. I think it's incredibly important that that we understand what people like Diana and other people who have experienced this type of loss have gone through. And I really do appreciate that you took the time not only to come on the show and share the story, but that you sat down and wrote the book, because I know from my own experience that it's not the easiest thing to do to write a book and relive these experiences and everything. But I also think it's an incredibly important thing to do, to share that with the world, really. So thank you again for joining us and for sharing your story.
Thanks, Scott, for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.